You.
Good evening. I'm Ellen. I'm a compulsive overeater. Very glad to be here. So what I was like, I was a fat, chubby kid. Well, we called it chubby to be polite. My whole life, I was overweight. By the time I was 13 or 14, my mother had me on all kinds of diets. I'm 71, so we're talking 1950s, 1960s. And I came from a family of overweight people. We were serious dieters. Food was restricted. Sweets were restricted. I became a sneak eater. I was pretty unhappy about my weight. It was in those days that in the 60s, Twiggy, I don't know if any of you were, some of you are old enough to remember Twiggy. The thing was to be rail thin. Now we know it is unhealthy, anorexic. But I could not come anywhere near that. I remember at one point being standing in line in gym class, which of course was all girls. We'd have to get weighed. This was not digital scales. These were the scales that, the little thing you had to push over to the 100 and then the 150. And the thing we were all looking for was to be under 100. I was an embarrassing 136, I remember at one point, which was at 5'6". I know now that's about what I am now at 5'2". But at that point, it was a little overweight, but nothing like all the girls who I really wanted to be like, who were 99 or 98 pounds. So I dieted. I became a really good dieter. I learned how to diet. My mother even took me to a diet doctor, which involved amphetamines, shots, pills, speed. I did all kinds of, crazy fad diets, and I would lose weight. I'm a very good dieter. I know it more than any nutritionist, I'm sure. I can tell you exactly. I can look at something, tell you how many ounces and how many calories and all that stuff because I grew up that way. And I could lose weight. I have great willpower. I could never keep it off for 5 minutes, but I could lose weight. So by the time I was 16, and I was also pretty unhappy for a lot of reasons. I was from a perfectly fine middle class. I'm New York Jewish family. I have no real excuses as to I wasn't abused or anything. I had everything I ever needed, but what I had was this disease of the mind, the spirit, and the body. By 16, I was unhappy, and I took every pill I could find in my house and tried to kill myself, get out of my misery. At that point, I got admitted to a psychiatric hospital for adolescents, which it's not done this way anymore, but I spent 9 months in a psychiatric hospital, age 16, where I learned how to drink, smoke, do drugs, have sex, all kinds of great introduction to the world. And when I got out, I was a pretty wild and crazy, rebellious teenager who then I spent the next from age 16 to 26. Doing this was I was a hippie and I dropped in and out of colleges a lot and just did all kinds of drugs and drinking and I was out of control in terms of substance abuse and I was continuing to struggle with my weight all that time too, but I found that drugs were a nice way to control my weight, my food being my number one love, of course. By age 26, I had many bad experiences, and finally got convinced by a friend to try AA. I got dragged to an AA meeting by a friend who didn't live much longer after that because he said I was going to overdose in no time at all the way I used. And I did go to that first AA meeting in Ann Arbor, Michigan, actually, in 45 years ago. It'll be 46 years. It's 45 and a half years ago, and I got clean and sober that day. And I haven't used since. However, I still had this big food problem. Well, down the hall, I'd rather on the bulletin board in the same room was going to be a few days later an Overeaters Anonymous meeting I saw. Never heard of OA, but boy, did I know every bet. Imagine what kind of diet program. And I said, oh, good, another diet program. Yay, that's me. So I went to my first OA meeting that same year, 1977. And it was cool. It was a cool support group. There were no scales, and it didn't even cost money. If I didn't want to, I could put money in the basket or not. And I got into this OA program, just like I got into AA. And I lost a bunch of weight. I had maybe 50, 60 pounds to lose at the time. I didn't really pay much attention to the steps or any of that stuff. I'm an atheist. I never had much of a, although I'm Jewish, I'm a Jewish atheist, a secular, you could call it. I never had much of a spiritual life, very traditional and celebrating the holidays, but I didn't have a God, you know, or a higher power in my life, my whole life. So I didn't really need this stuff, this 12 steps, but I sure loved the support group and all these 12 step programs. And I loved OA. So I would lose weight. I then proceeded to lose weight, get my act clean up. I got married, I met a guy, I got married, got a real job, had four kids. I kept going to meetings. However, I relapsed a number of times. Well, first of all, I had four pregnancies. And so I threw all out at the window and just went hard. I used as an excuse to go hard wild. And although I never picked up, drink or drugs again, but I did definitely pick up the food again after that. And I would gain all this weight. And then I'd say, I got to go back to OA. And I'd go back to OA and I'd lose more. Never really worked the steps, never really kept it off very long. But I did like the support group. I liked OA. These were my people. I knew I was home. Just didn't want to go all the way. I did eventually keep getting, with each relapse, bigger and bigger and bigger, till finally by age 60, about 12 years ago, I'm 71, I did hit a new kind of rock bottom. By then I was over 300 pounds. I don't know how far over it was. I think I was 305 on the scale, but I'd already dieted 2 weeks before that doctor appointment, so I could be lower. I was hoping to get under 300, but so I was over 300 something pounds. And I had cancer, the kind of cancer that's associated with obesity. It's an endometrial cancer. It's a kind of uterine cancer that is very heavily connected with obesity. I had high blood pressure that I wasn't always controlling with taking my medication. So I'd had a stroke, which fortunately only left me with a little double vision that's corrected with my glasses. It's amazing I made it this long and I'm still alive. I had full-blown diabetes on medication, not just pre-diabetes, but the full-blown, and all the other things that go along with morbid obesity. That was what I was, killing myself with food. I hit this new rock bottom at age 60-ish when my doctor said, stop dieting. Do not go on one more diet, because every time you go on a diet, you gain more weight. Better off, you shouldn't go on a diet. Instead, what he said is, let's figure out a sustainable food plan with a nutritionist. And I did go at that point to a residential treatment program, a fat farm, we called it those days, where I worked with the nutritionist to come up with a sustainable amount of food to eat that would be the amount of food to get to and maintain a healthy body weight. Now, this was not a diet. My way of dieting was always you eat as little as possible. You know, you go till like you wake up in the morning and you eat nothing, black coffee maybe. And then by 2 o'clock, you're starving and you start quickly snacking and go to the, and then by dinner, or rather after dinner, you know, you like lose it and go crazy. And then the next morning you wake up feeling guilty and start all over again. That was my diet. But this was not that. This is what you need to eat to get what your healthy body weight should be, which I'm at now, about 140, and start eating that way. And you will eventually lose the weight and get to there. The anti-diet, I call it. And I started that. And that's exactly what happened. It took me a few years to get to a healthy body weight. In fact, that last year, I remember there was 1 year about eight years ago, where I broke 150, which was for me a big deal at the time. And it was like the next year I was like 145. And then the next year I was 140. It was like, I wasn't even trying to lose weight. It was just my body was adjusting. And this was the kind of weight that I was meant to be, a healthy weight. I've been maintaining that weight for a number of years now, but I did have, and going on and off to OA, going to meetings, but not really doing kind of throwing myself into the program in the way that I came to and that I am now, with a sponsor and sponsoring. I did little bits here and there because I didn't really want the God stuff. I didn't really want the 12 steps. Those 12 steps, I had the cafeteria method. I like one. Yeah, I'm powerless over food. My life's unmanageable. No doubt about that. I didn't like two and three. Those were the God things. Skip over them. Go to four. Four is the moral inventory. Yeah, that's a psychology. I had many years from the time I was 16. I never really left therapy until about 5 years ago. And so, yeah, I could do therapy. That's I'm good at that. And so I would do four, and you know, four and five, that's kind of like therapy. And then six and seven, skip over, let's go to the men's. The men's are great. Eight, you know, whatever. So I would do this cafeteria method of the steps, never really fully, and because of that God stuff that I wanted to stay away from. I did, however, find myself 5 years ago, when, by then I'd moved to San Diego, and I found myself in, while I was thin, I was still obsessed with being fat, or not getting, rather eating, losing it all, being fat again. I mean, I'd had actually, after I lost all my weight, I went and had tummy tuck surgery, because I'd had between four kids and so much yo-yo dieting. I had all this excess skin, and I did it. I did like the tummy tuck surgery to get a nice flat abdomen. And I was so scared that I was going to gain a pound back and it was going to break, you know, this zipper that I have down. And I love being skinny. I didn't want, but however, every time I was around food, which is all the time, every day, I was struggling not to eat. So it was not what you call abstinence. It was called a dry drunk in food terms. I don't know what you call that in food terms, but that's basically what I was on. And I, so 5 years ago, I'd moved to San Diego. I remember at my first meeting in San Diego, I met a woman who is now still my sponsor. And I said, I showed her my before picture. Oh, let's do that. I can share my screen and show you my before picture. It's actually my, when I turn my camera off, you can see it, but I might as well share it here in big. This was me before that last, at that last relapse about 12, 13 years ago, smiling, but barely. And just while I have it there, that's me a few years ago, right before the pandemic, at my last big social event before the pandemic. So I did meet a sponsor, my woman who's now my sponsor. And I said, I'm really scared about gaining the weight back. And she said, you'd be surprised how much the skin can stretch. So I didn't like that answer. I said, really? And she was talking about, at every meeting I went to, they were talking about a thing I'd never heard before. I mean, I'd heard it, I just never heard it. Food neutrality. I didn't know what that was, because I didn't believe people really could, who were like me, people could really like care less about eating. Yeah, I kind of felt that way about drinking and drugs, but they weren't really my, I didn't have to work at that. I like realized I can't do drinking and drugs, so that was going to kill me, but I never could imagine feeling that way about food. Food, how could you say, I don't care about food, especially since you have to be around it all the time. And I would go to buffets and go crazy. And I couldn't stand it. I'd like, oh my God, I can't eat. I can't, constantly struggling with the whole night eating. But she talked about this food neutrality. And I said, okay, I really don't believe you, but tell me more about this to the people. I found this great meeting in San Diego, a maintainers meeting. We meet Saturday mornings at 8:30 in California time. It's on the San Diego website. It's a bunch of people who are lost all their weight and maintaining it. And there's a woman, we have a woman there who has just celebrated her 53rd year of abstinence, if you can believe. Great meeting. So, I said, tell me more about this. She said, just try it. Let's do the steps. Well, right around that time, I hit a Passover Seder, and I'm sitting at the Seder, and I'm my abstinence at the time, my food plan at the time was basically staying away from certain categories of foods, but not dieting. I don't weigh and measure, because I had such a this whole lifetime of all that. But I sat at this Passover Seder and I said, let me I just got to have some of this ceremonial food that's, even though it's in the category of foods I don't eat, because it's one of my binge foods, you know, my red light foods. But I figured I'd make an exception because it was Passover, it was a Seder, religious reasons, whatever. And what, you know, and the stupid thing is, I made this exception for, I don't know, are we allowed to mention food here? It was, I'll just say it was like cardboard, the thing that's like cardboard. That's what I made the exception for, would you believe? And sure enough, I used that as an excuse. By the end of the meal, I was having more stuff that was on. And it was months yet before I said, this is crazy. I gained maybe 10, 20 pounds, not a lot, but for me, it was like this whole, I'm gonna gain it all back. So at that point, I did get that sponsor and say, I got to get back on my abstinence. And I guess we'll try working the steps. those ones that I kept skipping. So gradually she took me through how to work those second and third steps. Those were the biggies for me. And, you know, coming to believe, what does that mean? A power greater than myself with a person who doesn't believe that stuff? Well, I did the whole method of, you know, believe in anything, believe in the group as a higher power, believe in a doorknob, believe in anything. All I know is that anything more than me. Well, in truth, the fact that I'd made it to this age and been through all the stuff I'd been through, trying to kill myself in so many ways, and I was still alive at almost, you know, at 65 when I should not have been alive, that was a miracle. And I realized that that miracle word is a kind of like a spiritual word. And for a person who doesn't believe in that stuff, well, it had happened. Furthermore, by then I'd had a husband who never knew me, you know, drinking or anything, but we're now married 43 years. He's a normie. And I have four normie grown kids. Don't ask me how. I guess it's my husband's genetics, and maybe they using me as a bad example of how not to be, and they are normal people. That's a miracle. So somehow or another, I made it to this stage of being alive, being healthier than I've ever been, no more diabetes, lost all this weight, keeping it off, trying that step too. So I made my own definition of my higher power. I wrote it out. It's on my bulletin board. It's a kind of a humanistic definition of higher power, of all the good stuff in people, all the good stuff in the world, love, et cetera, of how we're meant to be the best of all of us. We're meant to do that. And that's what I did for my second and third step. And I continue to do to this day as my version. And I love this program because we all come up with our own versions of what higher power and spirituality is to us. And I do, you know, when I read the book and I talk to that G word, you know, I do my translation in my head, but it works for me. And sure enough, somewhere along the line in this past 5 years of continuous abstinence since that fateful Passover Seder, I found myself in a bakery, looking at a bakery case full of stuff to get something for my husband for his birthday, and finding that I had no interest in the stuff in that case. And I felt as if I was in a hardware store looking at a display of nuts and bolts. And I didn't know enough, I don't know enough from a bolt or a screw from a nail, but there it was, as uninteresting to me as if that's where I was. And I would no sooner put that stuff in my mouth than the stuff in the case would I put in my mouth, because that's not for me. Just like I don't go into that aisle with a lid with those, you know, alcoholic beverages in a grocery store, I don't go into that aisle. I don't go. Those things are not for me. Like a person who is allergic to nuts would not take any nuts because they'll die. Well, that's what I've done. I have brainwashed myself that my abstinence is, that stuff's not for me. There's plenty of stuff that is for me. You know, I also keep kosher and vegetarian. So there's a whole bunch of categories of foods I don't eat. And that's how it works for me. However, my abstinence is more than just food. My abstinence is food behaviors. There are three definitions the definition of abstinence is doing three things simultaneously, right? Abstaining from compulsive foods, compulsive food behaviors, while working towards it or maintaining a healthy body weight. My compulsive food behaviors could fill a book. You name it, I did it. Eating out of the trash, eating out of the garbage disposal, I did it. God forbid I should have, you know, almost turned it on when I stuck my hand in there, because I would try to save my locking food away. I at one point we had a refrigerator in the garage that my husband put a padlock on, and I made him hide the key. And I can't tell you how many nights when he was in bed, I went looking for that key to find the food that I told him to lock away from me. I did it all. Sneaking and throwing, you know, I'm very much against littering, but boy, however many times I threw candy wrappers out of the car while driving because I didn't want to get home and have them find candy wrappers. And all those behaviors, you name them, I did them all. Those are the food behaviors that I abstain from now. Those are the food behaviors that are part of my disease. So that's what I was like. So then I told you what happened was I got a sponsor and I started working the steps. But then I did need to do more than that. And along came the pandemic and offered me a great opportunity to do something else, service. And what happened in my life is that I'd had a lot of depression in my life, on and off, a lot of treatment, a lot of outside help, professional help. And even so, I had still this kind of underlying depression, even when I was at a good point, and much worse when I was at a bad point. Then I lived my life for my kids, for my job. At one point, my father needed me. I took care of him. kids grow up or they leave, jobs you retire from, or they disappoint you, you know, bosses you don't get along with, and et cetera. I found myself that I did not have a life worth living. And that was connected to my depression. I did not have a life fulfilling. I found no purpose in life. I could live through my kids, but only so much, live through my job, only so much. Part of my change that I attribute to whatever higher power definition I can come up with, that spiritual growth that I've had, has been that I have found a life worth living, and that is through service. Service, certainly in this program, but also service in the world.
That Ellen, it's 20 minutes.
Thank you. And then I feel that I have gotten so much from this world and taken advantage of it without giving back. And I started after I retired, and this was also, again, about 10 years ago when I gave up dieting and started a real abstinence. I started giving back to the world and started doing volunteering for social service agencies, volunteering using the skills that I have, which are teaching and computers, and started teaching digital literacy to seniors, something that I still do to this day. And along came Zoom, and I found I could do all kinds of service online. I'm now a Zoom teacher for hosts. Some of my students are right here in this very room. And also I do websites. I'm a web developer. And so I found a number of different websites in a way that have needed my skills. These are the kinds of service that make my life fulfilling. Being able to just donate blood because I'm now healthy. Being able to teach kids. I volunteer at schools, you know, after school programs to tutor kids how to read. These are the things that have given my life worth meaning, given me a reason to continue to live and make me feel like I am, there is a reason for me to go on because I have skills and I can give back to the world that's given me so much. And I want to finish on that note of service and why it's so important to me by reading from the big book on page 89. This is the chapter, Working with Others. This is a really important part of me on how I maintain my program and keep going on and how much I've learned out of life. It's step 12, working with others. So I'm going to read, practical experience shows, nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking, you substitute your own word, as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. I get teary when I read this every time, and I'm not a crier. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. That is why I sponsor about 10, 12 people all the time, especially newcomers, because everybody in these little boxes here, you are the bright spot of my lives. And without you, I have had no purpose, but with you and all those other people, I find that we together get better and I maintain and keep my program, live a life worth living. Thank you, fellows in OA. Thank you, all my good friends. Thank you for letting me share.